Today is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, the annual World Economic Forum is underway in Switzerland. We'll look at the goals of the meetings. With new North Korean nuclear sites discovered this week, we'll examine what this means for next month's summit. And we'll visit a famous market in Seattle where the fish are flying.
And then instead of me walking it all the way around, I would say, one sockeye, one sockeye, hey, yeah.
It's all on today's International Edition. As the partial U.S. government shutdown enters its second month, the U.S. Senate prepares for votes Thursday on separate Republican and Democratic proposals to end it. Joining me to discuss the impact the shutdown is having is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thanks for being with us. Let's begin with the upcoming Senate votes. Is either one expected to pass?
As of right now, Jim, it looks as though neither one is going to get to this 60-vote total you need in the Senate to move ahead. The Republicans control the Senate, of course. The Democrats, since last year's midterm election, now control the House. So this gets very complicated in terms of governance. One bill before the Senate is basically the president's what he describes as a compromise proposal from a few days ago that would get all his border wall money and make some concessions on temporary protection for dreamers in the country. The other bill offered by Democrats is to temporarily reopen the government and then negotiate over border security for a few weeks. As I say, neither one has the outlook of passing at the moment. I guess we'll see when the results come down, when the votes come down, both sides will get to assess sort of how they stand. Are they holding their members, on their own side? I think that'll be a key thing to look at.
Well, there doesn't seem to be much negotiation going on, at least not publicly. If these bills fail, is this a starting point for real negotiations?
Right. I mean, most people see this as somewhat of an exercise, not likely to succeed. But your point is well taken. People are hoping at least this is the beginning of something that will get the two sides looking at possible compromises. I think one key thing, though, is we just heard several reports in the last day or so that, there's been really no contact officially between President Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for a couple of weeks. So we haven't even gotten to the point where the two principals are talking. We also have the backdrop of public opinion polls, though, that seem to show most of the blame at the moment going toward the president and Republicans, not so much the Democrats.
So then at this point, the Democrats would seem to have the stronger hand.
Right. And I think the speaker is going to be trying to urge her members to hold the line. In terms of party discipline. But the problem is the president has so much tied up in the border wall in terms of what he believes are his reelection prospects for 2020. And the interesting thing about the polls as well, there's a CBS poll out today that shows that 71% of those surveyed do not believe the shutdown is worth trying to get the wall money. And the other thing, there's been a couple of polls of late that show some erosion in the president's support among Republicans. Not a lot, more coming down from, say, in the 90% area, down closer to 80%. But it shows sort of a trickle away on some of these issues. Is that enough to convince the president to want to deal with the Democrats? It's hard to say right now.
Well, you mentioned that the president could be eyeing the next round of elections, 2020, when he would run for reelection. He's obviously playing to his base, but as you pointed out, 71% are against the border wall funding. At what point does he step back and say, am I hurting my reelection chances?
Right. And I'm not sure we're there yet, because particularly if you look at the Senate Republicans, and maybe we'll see this in the votes on Thursday, They seem to be backing the president. As long as he feels the party is backing his strategy, he's probably going to keep going. The problem was at the very beginning of this effort, among those who questioned it was the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who said, what is the end game here? What is the out at the end of this process? And no one seems to be talking about that. And that's why there's a lot of concern here in Washington and around the country that this could go on indefinitely. And we're already seeing lines of federal workers, people lining up for free food around D.C. and in other parts of the country needing help. Another paycheck is due at the end of this week, and right now the prospects are not good for those checks to be, in the mail, so to speak.
We just have a few seconds remaining. What does this shutdown and the negotiating tactics of both sides tell us about divided government over the next 2 years?
Looks like it's going to be pretty rocky. That was the expectation anyway. And we haven't even gotten to the investigations that we expect House Democrats to start launching at the president and his administration. So it could get even rockier in the months ahead.
VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone, thank you so much for your time.
You bet.
This is International Edition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Thailand's Election Commission has set March 24th as the date for the country's first general elections since the 2014 military coup. An Australian newspaper says a Chinese-Australian writer and dissident has been detained during a visit to China. South Korea says a Japanese military aircraft made a threatening low-altitude flight over one of its naval vessels Wednesday, describing it as a provocative act. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
The U.S. Geological Survey says 71% of the Earth's surface is covered with water. A couple of recent studies have also suggested that there are oceans of water deep inside our planet's mantle. Scientists suggest after its formation about 4.53 billion years ago, Earth was a dry, hot, and molten planet. A heavy bombardment of water and ice-bearing asteroids and comets several million to a billion years later provided the supply of H2O we rely on today. Now, research by a team of geoscientists from Arizona State University proposes another source of Earth's water they say has been overlooked. The sun and planets were formed from a large cloud of gas and dust containing an abundant supply of hydrogen. The study suggests a combination of all that hydrogen, along with Earth's rocky materials, could be the origin of most of our planet's water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for making us a part of your day. The annual World Economic Forum is underway in Switzerland against a backdrop of anxieties over trade disputes, Brexit, and a growth slowdown that some fear could tip the world economy. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
Some 3,000 businesses, government, and ordinary citizens are meeting in the Swiss city of Davos this week. Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum, says that strengthening global cooperation is a must for the world economy, which has experienced a slow and uneven recovery since the global financial crisis in 2008.
I think we are walking on relatively thin ice because as our global risk report, which we published some days ago, has shown, there are many threats to the global economy. I think it's very important to strengthen global cooperation. That's what we want to achieve here in Davos.
The WEF's own Global Risks Report set the tone this week with a stark warning of a looming economic downturn, in part because of geopolitical tensions among major powers. Several world leaders stayed away, including U.S. President Donald Trump, who's grappling with the country's longest government shutdown in U.S. history. But his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, addressed anxieties over a trade dispute with China during a video conference.
There are those who say that conflict, superpower conflict between our two countries is inevitable. We don't see it that way. We want to find places where we can work together.
Pompeo stressed that cooperation between the two countries can only work if some conditions are met.
Free and open seas, the capacity for nations to take their goods around the world, fair and reciprocal trade arrangements where every country has the opportunity to compete on a fair, transparent, and open basis.
Another leader who didn't attend was British Prime Minister Theresa May, who survived a no-confidence vote after her Brexit withdrawal agreement was recently rejected, an issue of concern for this attendee.
I think if we get a hard Brexit, the consequences are such that it will be a major disruption, and I think it's very difficult to prepare for that. So we're really hoping for and banking on the fact that the people will come to their senses and that we will have regimes that will ensure that we can continue the way that we're doing today.
While economic growth is slowing, the aid charity Oxfam warned the Davos elite that income inequality around the world is not. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
French and German leaders warned against growing threats to the European Union as they signed a new friendship treaty this week. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports for VOA that a spat over African migration between Italy and France underscores the challenges of shoring up European unity.
The signing ceremony at Aachen City Hall was an opportunity for French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel to underscore just how far Europe has evolved since the last friendship treaty between their two nations in 1963, but also to warn of threats facing the European Union.
Au moment où notre Europe est menacée par les nationalismes qui se développent en son sein,
speaking to an audience that included EU and local officials, Macron said that at a time when Europe is shaken by nationalism and Brexit, as well as broader international shocks like climate change and terrorism, France and Germany need to lead the way in strengthening the bloc. This new deal aims to deepen French-German cooperation in areas like education, defense, and foreign policy.
Das alles wird nur gehen, wenn wir es gleichzeitig mit einer Koordinierung in unserer Außenpolitik verbinden.
German Chancellor Merkel also called for closer cooperation in development policy, especially when it comes to Africa. Like Macron, she also warned about rising populism within Europe and global threats to multilateralism. The new cooperation treaty faces criticism, with some claiming it does not go far enough, while in France, false claims spread on social media suggested Macron's government was willing to cede French territory and its UN Security Council seat to Germany. Hours before the signing, a diplomatic spat over remarks by Italy's Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio, blaming migrant arrivals on France's so-called colonization of Africa, underscored the rifts in the European Union.
Europa potrzebuje dziś odrodzenia wiary w sens solidarności i jedności.
European Council President Donald Tusk called for reviving European unity and solidarity, warning of doubts and discouragement in the European Union by its citizens. He said the bloc needs a clear signal from France and Germany in this direction.
You still need the French and the German to take the bolder initiatives.
Manuel Lafont-Trapnoy is head of the Paris office of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
There's no real initiative that is able to get traction from any other coalition in Europe.
But Lafont-Trapnoy says while French and German leadership is key, it is not enough today to move an increasingly disparate and divided EU forward. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
One of some 20 undeclared ballistic missile operating bases in North Korea serves as a missile headquarters. That is part of the findings of a new report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The discovery of an undeclared missile headquarters comes just days after President Trump announced he looks forward to another summit to discuss denuclearization with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late February. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Paul Evans, professor in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Well, I don't think that the discovery of the missile base, while it's new news, it's an old story. There's been no effort by the North Koreans to disclose or identify where their nuclear and their missile capabilities lie. So this is not a I don't think it's a new piece of information that suddenly clouds the meeting. This is the reality of the situation. The U.S. North Korea discussion at the head of government level is very preliminary. It has not even got to the basics yet of exactly what can be revealed, what can't be revealed, much less then how things are going to start being removed.
What kind of effect might that have on the next summit meeting if it is to take place?
It would be difficult to imagine this stopping the meeting because both sides have known that this has not yet been part of even an agreement on the declaration of facilities. It underlines how difficult this next summit meeting is going to be on the basis of there having been very little progress on any of the inferred actions by North Korea and the United States still not winding down the sanctions. So it's almost as if we're in a time warp where we're going back as if it's a first meeting that didn't cover some ground. Whether it can or not, the odds are not very high that something breakthrough is going to come here, but hope springs eternal.
Evans, that's Paul Evans, professor in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
You're listening to International Edition from VOA. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled the Trump administration can restrict military service by transgender men and women. This as lower court challenges to the policy change continue. Los Angeles-based civil rights attorney Angela Reddick Wright spoke with VOA's Lori London, who asked if this is unusual since the issue is still being argued in the lower courts.
I would venture to guess that it's more politically motivated than out of a necessity to make a decision at this time. Justice Roberts would disagree with that and would argue that his court is not politically influenced.
What does this mean for transgender people already in the military who are serving at this point?
So what the ban means if you're currently serving in the military is you can continue to serve as long as you are willing to serve while openly and willingly revealing your biological sex, in essence, by serving in the gender that you were born with. If you're not, then there's a possibility that you would be discharged. And of course, if you are transgender and you're interested in joining the military, there's a ban on your joining until the final decision is made by the Supreme Court.
I would imagine that would be a difficult decision for transgender military people that are already serving, given that that's whatever sex they've decided to be, that that's what they identify with. So they would have to sort of transform themselves back to something they don't feel that they are?
Right. They have to make a decision that goes against the choice they've made in terms of their gender, and most likely would have to make sure that they dress and associate and do everything associated with their biological sex or gender. So that would be a difficult decision. And for those that also, you know, take it on as a position of advocacy, they also would have to compromise what they've advocated for in terms of transgender rights. So it definitely puts those of a transgender background and that make the choice to be transgender, that are transgender, in a difficult position.
That's civil rights attorney Angela Reddick Wright. I'm Jim Bertel, and this is VOA's International Edition. Seattle is known for its ambitious startup companies and high-tech giants, but it is also home to one of the oldest farmers market in America. VOA's Anna Rice takes us to Pike Place Market.
Seattle's Pike Place Market stretches for four city blocks. It includes a collection of old buildings, hundreds of stalls, and street musicians and actors that draw both locals and visitors. The famed market wakes up each day at 5 a.m. Among the first to arrive, flower vendors and fishmongers like Jason Scott.
My mother worked here before I was born. She used to put me in a banana box behind the counter, this nice cardboard box as a cradle. So I was behind the counter as a baby. And then when I was about 9 or 10, I started working. Put an apron on, and I would just ice the fish and sell, you know, little things here and there. And I came back out of high school and been here ever since. I'm 46 now. So.
His stand is known for its tradition of throwing a fish before wrapping it up for a customer.
And then instead of me walking it all the way around, I would say, one sockeye, hey, yeah.
Scott says fish throwing is easy.
TT, hey, oh, yes, good. Turn sideways. No, other sideways. Keep going. Yep, there you go. Thank you. TT for Natasha. TT for Natasha. And, whoa! Wow!
Many Pike Place Market stores are family-run and have been around for generations. Russian-speaking immigrants opened Piroshki Bakery 25 years ago.
Not a lot of people understand what piroshkis are. People think sometimes it's a last name. So we do have to educate people a lot. So piroshkis are fresh baked pies. And the reason it's called piroshki is if you go to Russia and you go to a market like this, you could hear ladies scream out, piroshki, and that's why we call it piroshki.
Next to piroshki is a Chinese bakery called Mi Sun Pastry. It's owned by the third generation of the Fong family. They call their signature pastry the best and biggest hanbaos in town.
The hanbao is kind of like a Chinese hamburger. It's filled with the meat. You can put a chicken or barbecue pork or curry beef, even vegetable.
But in this sprawling market, one of the most unusual places isn't a food or craft stall. It's the gum wall, where people can stick their tiny, chewed-up clump on a roll. Some apparently don't give it much thought. Others try to be original.
This gum wall started about 20 years ago when the theater asked people to not bring gum inside because they didn't want it under the seats. So people would put gum up on the outside.
Market officials initially tried to clear the sticky stuff off the wall, but new gum always reappeared, so they finally gave up. The gum wall quickly became a tourist attraction.
We manage anarchy here, and sometimes you just let it go.
And just like that, gum anarchy turned into an attraction, highlighting a more eccentric side of Seattle that locals and visitors love. For Natasha Mozgovaya in Seattle, Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And Pike Place Market is one of those things that you have to go to if you're ever in Seattle. It's fun, it's great food, and is just such a great place. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. My thanks to our studio team, Director Jackson Vungani, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for listening.
welcome to Upfront on the Voice